Good morning. It's good to be back. I've been gone two Sundays this month, and we don't have any other trips or gospel meetings planned until December. So I'll be here for a little while, I suppose. It's good to be back, though. Samantha and I were in Asher. We're just in St. Louis this last week. We stayed. I did a meeting at the Kirkwood Church of Christ where Kathy Bunn's brother is, Alan Bagley. And Alan and Joanne miss so many of you guys. They have so many good things to say about all of you. And I didn't realize that St. Louis had so much to do in it, too. They had a gooey butter cake, which is a really good dessert that I'd never had before. They also had pork steaks, and I've never had one of those either, but that was just amazing. So, but anyways, it's good to be back. Tonight there's going to be a Devo at the Costas's, and we're going to be in Proverbs chapter 21, so all of the junior high, high school, college-age kids are more than welcome to come to that. If this is one of the first times that you've been here, you're kind of stepping into the middle of a conversation because every first Sunday morning of the month, we're doing a theme that I've titled Restoring the Icon. And the concept behind these lessons is that we were made in God's image, which means that we were created to reflect God's character. And the reason that we don't do that the way that we ought to is because of sin. Every time we sin, it mars or it cracks the image that we were supposed to represent. Hence the picture here where you've got this statue that's been cracked. That's really what's become of our souls because of the sin that we've committed. And the Bible teaches that it's through discipline, through concerted effort, that's one of the ways that God restores us and puts us back together. So up to this point, these are the things that we've looked at. We've talked about the discipline of study, meditation, prayer, fasting, joy, discernment, confession, guidance. Look at how far we are into the year, by the way. It's gone by really quick. So we're in worship this morning. That's what we're going to be talking about. And I just want you to think, this last week, when you or if you used the word worship, in what sense did you use that word? And my guess would be that the majority of the time that we used that word, we meant it in terms of coming to this building and then singing some songs and offering some money and hearing a lesson and taking the Lord's Supper and things of that nature. The Bible would teach that the concept of worship is much bigger than that. What we're doing right now is one facet of worship, or it would be one example of worship. But the Bible teaches that it's a much bigger concept. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 2. You can be turning your Bibles there if you're not there already, but we'll be there in just a moment. I just want to remind us, in these series of lessons, this is the text that we've been basing these lessons off of, Hebrews 12, 10 and 11. Says, for they, referring to our earthly fathers, disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Notice that here the writer of Hebrews is saying that discipline is for our good. And the reason that the writer of Hebrews has to say that is because in the moment when you're getting disciplined by something, it doesn't feel good in the moment all the time. Think about how that would apply to the concept of worship. Do you always look forward to worshiping? Is it something that you always want to do every day that you live? We have to be convinced that this discipline is something that's for our good, and it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. How many of you in this room want peace? Everybody in the world wants peace. But it's going to come through momentary displeasure in order to ever get to the point where I finally have peace, and worship is one of the disciplines where that happens. Now, the text that we're going to be looking at, you'll see the word worship three times. And two times it's going to be used by people who genuinely want to worship, and one time it's going to be used by a fraudulent person. Some people can claim that they want to worship, but not really mean it. We're going to go look at Matthew chapter 2, and it's going to be verses 1 through 12. And this is not a scene where you see people gathered together to sing hymns, and it's not the conventional way that we use the word worship. But look at this scene, and this is a great picture of what worship really is. Look at Matthew chapter 2, and we're going to read verses 1 through 12. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it was written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who shall shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I may too come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it arose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Now, immediately when we read a scene like this, we get familiar with this because getting close to Christmas time, there's people that are going to have nativity sets all over the place in neighborhoods and things like that. And there are certain songs that people sing about scenes like this one that might lead to some misunderstandings of it. For example, if you think about the wise men here, a lot of people think that there were three wise men, but we're not told in this scene how many people there are. What we are told is that they bring three gifts, and a lot of people have assumed, therefore, that there were three wise men. For Christmas time, if I give Samantha, like I normally do, 100 gifts for Christmas, that doesn't mean she has 100 husbands. She knows that that's not true, and all of you do know that too. But we're not told how many. There could be 30 wise men. We don't know how many there were. But some versions, your version might have said the word magi instead of wise men. Magi is, in the ancient world, a magi was like an astrologer, and he was somebody who was highly educated. They were the smart people of the world, and this same word is used in the book of Daniel to refer to the wise men who Nebuchadnezzar wanted to have interpret the dreams for him. Now, when you read the book of Daniel, how wise do the wise men seem? They never seem very wise. They're never able to answer any of the king's dreams or visions or anything like that. And in the Old Testament, these kinds of people are painted in a very negative light. But here you get to the Gospel of Matthew, and you read about these highly educated, sophisticated people, and Matthew's portraying them in a positive light. Now, if you look at verse 2, you'll see that these people came from the east, which means that they're traveling west. They came from the east. What countries would have been from the east? Babylon, for example, would have been one of the nations. And it's possible that these people would have been influenced by the prophet Daniel. And based on the things that Daniel had written, based on the things that Daniel had said, they had deduced throughout history that they needed to come at a certain time to Jerusalem whenever there was going to be a king that was born. By the way, if the Jewish people looked down on magi, look what Matthew's doing. He's beginning his gospel by saying, here are some magi, and they were the first people to worship Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. Now, if this story was made up, do you think Matthew, a Jewish author, would have had magi being the first worshipers of Jesus? It wouldn't have happened. This story actually happened. One of the mysterious things that you'll see in this scene is the star, though. The star is the thing that leads these wise men to Jesus, and a lot of people have had different speculations on what the star was. Here's three speculations. Some people have said that it was a comet. Some people have said that it was planetary conjunction. That's where several planets come together, and it creates like something that looks like a really bright star, especially bright. Some people think that it was a nova. There was, in China, I guess, around this time period, apparently a nova that was seen for 70 days. But try to think about what the star does in this scene. These wise men, these astrologers, They see some star in the sky, and it leads them to Jerusalem. Now, would any of these things potentially lead them to Jerusalem? Yeah, maybe to Jerusalem. But once they get to Jerusalem, the star has to specifically guide them to Jesus' house. So none of these options really make sense. Because the star, therefore, must have been obviously some supernatural kind of thing that we see going on here. But here's a question. Does the Old Testament say anything about the star? Do we read anything in the Old Testament about it? Remember Balaam, who was hired by Balak to curse the nation of Israel in the book of Numbers? And every time he was going to curse God's people, the Spirit of God came into him and just basically forced him to speak blessings on God's people rather than curses like he was hired to do. One of the blessings, by the way, Balaam was a Gentile, and the wise men would have been Gentiles, and I wonder if this was shared amongst the Gentiles, this information. Balaam says this in Numbers 24, verses 17 to 19. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab, and break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be dispossessed, Seir also, his enemies shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly, and from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of cities. Here, Balaam is saying, there's this man that's going to come into the future. I don't see him yet, but a star is going to appear, and it's going to give indication that this man has finally come. By the way, when this scepter comes, this rule, Edom shall be dispossessed. In this scene, who's the king? Herod. Do you know of what descent he was? Idumean, or an Edomite. And he's the one in this scene that's very concerned about what's happening. But notice in verses 5, 6, and 8, one of the things that you're going to see repeated in this scene is Bethlehem. The writer of Matthew is making a big deal of noticing the fact that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and Micah 5:2 is quoted to prove that. In Micah 5, you've got this scene, or you've got this section in Micah where it's judging the leaders of the nation, and then saying, but the true shepherd, the righteous ruler, is going to come from this lowly town of Bethlehem. By the way, in the Old Testament, who else was from Bethlehem? King David, who was literally a shepherd of literal sheep, and then he became the figurative shepherd of the nation. And here's Jesus being born in the same place. Now, why would Matthew need to make a big deal out of that? Think about the audience of Matthew. Matthew's writing to Jewish people. And if you're a Jew, you think of Jesus being from Nazareth, and he was from Nazareth. He grew up there. And you might have questions that your scripture said he was going to be born in Bethlehem. Here's the story in the Bible that would have shown a Jewish audience who's reading this book that Jesus was indeed born in Bethlehem, but shortly thereafter goes to Nazareth. So this does fulfill the scripture. Notice in verse 1, though, this whole scene takes place during the days of Herod. The days of Herod, that's a phrase that you could easily pass over very quickly. If you know throughout history what people have said about this man, like I said earlier, was part Gentile, and the Romans established him as the king. And this man was so insecure of his throne that he killed two of his sons. And from what I understand, he also killed at least one of his wives. Some people have said that it would have been better to be one of his pigs than one of his sons. Because he wouldn't have killed the pig, but he would have killed his sons. Herod reigned from 37 BC to 4 BC. And when it says in verse 1 that this took place during the days of Herod, it sets up a very ominous tone for what we're going to see here. So I want you to imagine what happens here. In verse 1, it says, after the birth of Jesus, or after Jesus was born. We are not told how long after Jesus was born that this scene happens. It's likely that Jesus could have been upwards to 2 years old, and there's reasons for that later on in the chapter. But after Jesus was born, there's wise men from the east that show up to Jerusalem. I want you to picture these guys walking into Jerusalem. How do you think they dressed? I imagine that they had very expensive attire. they would have been very distinguished from everybody else around them. And here they are in their entourage coming into the city of Jerusalem. And I imagine them going up to different various people and they're saying, where is he who's been born king of the Jews? And they're asking all the people in the city. How do you think the people in the city are responding? Man, we don't know. You guys, nice jacket, by the way, but we don't know. And then eventually all these people are talking about it to the point where one of the servants of the king, I picture him going to the king's chamber, and he bolts open the door and he says, people are saying that the king of the Jews has been born. And I want you to imagine Herod, as soon as he hears that, based on what we know about him, the text says in verse 3 that he's troubled. You can imagine as soon as he hears that the claim of this man that's been born king of the Jews is here, his face just drops and he gulps really loudly and he gets really quiet. But it doesn't just say that Herod was troubled. It says all Jerusalem with him was troubled. Why does it say that? You ever heard the phrase before, when mama ain't happy, ain't nobody's happy? Because when mama's not happy, it affects the whole household, right? When Herod, this very insecure man, gets troubled, everybody else gets troubled along with him, because what's this crazy maniac gonna do about the situation? So what does Herod do? What Herod does is he calls an emergency meeting, and it says in verse 4, he gets all the chief priests and the scribes. Imagine this meeting as it takes place. He calls together all of these people, all the experts of the nation of Israel, and he's asking them, where is it that Jesus is supposed to be born? He doesn't know his name yet, obviously, but where is he supposed to be born? By the way, the role of the king was to lead people in God's paths. Isn't it ironic that the king doesn't even know Micah 5? So you get all of these people that are having to tell him, well, here it is in Micah 5. They unroll the scroll and they say, this is where he was supposed to be born. And so with that information, what King Herod does is he calls a secret meeting in verse 7. Now, if you have to have a secret meeting, there's already something suspicious about that. But he secretly calls in all of the wise men and he tries to ascertain from them what time the star originally appeared. Now, why would he try to figure that out from the wise men? I think he's assuming that when they first saw the star, that was an indication Jesus was born. And he's trying to figure out, how long have you guys been traveling? So I can figure out how old this child is. So he finds out from them exactly how long it's been, and then he tells them, okay, thank you so much for the information. Search diligently, he says. Search diligently for the child, and when you found him, let me know so I can go worship him. Do you think the wise men initially believed Herod? I think the wise men initially are thinking, well, yeah, we want to see him too. I'm glad that the king of Israel, who's currently reigning, is on board with the same thing that we want. So they go on their merry way and they go to Bethlehem. Bethlehem would have been a trek of about 5 miles. When Samantha and I came back yesterday, we had 2 plane flights. The first one was from St. Louis to San Francisco and then San Francisco to San Diego. And the second plane ride was 1.5 hours, and it seemed like nothing compared to how long the first flight was. When you get closer and closer to the end of a trip, it doesn't seem very long. So you imagine these wise men, they're finally in the vicinity of this man that they want to come and see, or this child that they want to come and see, and they get to Jerusalem, and I imagine that the star comes right on top of the house, and then they all look at each other, and they get really excited, and they knock on the door. Why don't you imagine being the person that opens up the door? You open up the door and there's these, I don't know how many wise men. And they've got bundles of gifts. And they're saying, where is he that's been born king of the Jews? And then they look into the back of the house and you've got Mary holding the baby Jesus. And then she looks at these wise men. She's thinking, what in the world's going on here? But they all come up to Jesus and they worship him and they give him very costly gifts, which we'll talk more about in just a second. But they're giving him all of these gifts, which, by the way, is a fulfillment of a passage like Isaiah 60 verse 6. It says, a multitude of camels shall cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah, Although those from Sheba shall come, they shall bring gold and frankincense and shall bring good news, the praises of the Lord. Notice that it specifically here talks about frankincense. That's one of the gifts that are mentioned here. But it talks about people from Sheba coming. Does this remind you of anything in the Old Testament? When King Solomon was reigning as the king, and you've got the Queen of Sheba that comes and she presents gifts to him. The wealth of the nation streaming to God's people. Jesus would say later in Matthew chapter 12 that somebody greater than Solomon is here. And in fact, when he's a baby, he's getting gifts from people. So here's the wise men. They're taking all of their worldly wisdom and laying it at the feet of Jesus, finally being able to see the one that they had been traveling for I don't know how long to see. You can imagine that as they go to bed that night, they sleep really well knowing that their mission was accomplished. But what's ironic in verses 11 and 12-ish is that you have these men receiving a dream, and they're told to go a different direction and not go see Herod. And what do? They do exactly what the dream says. Isn't it interesting when you contrast these wise men to the ones in the Old Testament? In the Old Testament, the wise men never understood dreams and never interpreted them properly. But then you've got these wise men who are getting a dream from God, and they're able to understand it perfectly, and they go a different route. Now, what does this interesting scene teach us about worship? I'd suggest that the first thing this scene teaches us about worship is that worship perceives the worth of something. The word worship is an interesting one. It comes from the words worth and ship. To worship something means that you place worthiness on something. In other words, another way you could say that is you're seeing how valuable something is. And one of the definitions for the word worship is actually kneeling to do homage. Why would you kneel before something? Except that you've realized how superior to yourself that it is. And we can't miss this in the scene that these wise men come to Jesus before his ministry ever started. You want to know why that's interesting to me? Because Jesus up to this point never healed anybody. He never proclaimed the forgiveness of sins. He never helped people with leprosy. He hadn't died on the cross yet. And what is it that causes people a lot of the times and us a lot of the times to worship Jesus? It's for those things that he did, and that's appropriate. But here's the point. These guys realize the inherent worth of God. Why do you think of God as being valuable to you? If it's only for the things he's done for you, we might be missing the fact that he's worthy in and of himself. He's the creator. He's the sustainer. He's all powerful. He's all knowing. And when we realize those things about him, we'll realize that before he's even done anything for us, he's worthy of complete adoration and worship. Now, if you look at a passage like Romans 12, 1 and 2, says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Notice here that Paul's appealing to the Christians. He's not commanding them. He's appealing to them. He's saying, please, I'm appealing to you based on the things God has done for you, so that is one of the reasons to worship, and he's using that motivation here. But he wants these Christians to present their bodies as a living sacrifice, and he wants their minds to be engaged in this. Notice, by the way, in these two verses, that worship involves the body and the mind. Are there some people who emphasize one of those to the neglect of the other? Have you ever known people that just wanted their mind stimulated or their emotions stimulated, but when it came time to worshiping and ascribing worth to God, they didn't live it out throughout the week? But then you've got other people that are talking about wanting to do things for God and wanting to be active, but they're not very emotional about it, or they're not very knowledgeable about what God has actually said. True worship engages the whole person, body and mind. And one without the other isn't true worship. By the way, think about how you see that in the Magi. these magi have traveled possibly from Babylon. Did that engage their bodies? These wise men, they're following the direction of the star. Did that involve their intellect? The wise men also, when they hear that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, which would have been a lowly city, you've got this earthly wise, these earthly wise people, and they're willing to say, well, maybe it's possible that a king has been born in a lowly city. And we're not going to base things out of our own understanding. You see, in all of the steps that the wise men are taking, that they're ascribing ultimate worth to God, and because of that, they're kneeling down before Him with everything that He's told them to do. That's what true worship is. When you really worship God, you're kneeling before Him, not just on Sundays and Wednesdays. You're kneeling before Him in your thoughts. You're kneeling before Him in your actions. You see in this scene that worship, when you really worship something, it's tangible. There's something tangible about it as they bring gifts and they travel. You ever heard Christians complain about how long they have to drive to come to the church building? How far did these guys have to travel? When you really see the worth of the one that you're worshiping, all of those things go into the rear view mirror, no pun intended, and you're able to really understand that there's something valuable about what I'm doing here. Worship, first of all, is perceiving the worth of something, but notice something else here, is that worship is universal. We just talked about worshiping God here, but this is an important point to make from this scene. A lot of people would classify the world with two different kinds of people. There's people who worship and there's people that don't worship. The truth is this. Everybody worships something. Some people worship things that distort you and destroy you. And other people worship things that bring everything in your life in order. So for example, in this scene, you have King Herod and he's worshiping something, right? I mean, he at least claims that he's going to worship Jesus, but what is it that he actually worships other than himself? He likes the idea of his throne. He likes the idea of his authority and his pomp and his all of that kind of thing. Now, part of worship involves sacrifice. What is it that Herod sacrifices later in the chapter? Look at verse 16 of Matthew chapter 2. It says, then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all the region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Here's Herod, and he's worshiping his throne, and because of that, he's insecure about it, and what does he sacrifice but everybody around him? You ever known somebody like that? I want to be looked at in a certain way. I want respect. I want honor. And if you don't give it to me, I'm going to kill you. Not literally, but with my words. The burden that you put on other people when you worship like Herod does. When the 2008 stock market crash happened, there were some people who committed suicide. You want to know why? It's because they were worshiping something that can be taken away. What's Herod doing here? He's worshiping something that can be taken away by a child. What do you worship? And if you worship something that can be taken away, what you end up having is a Herod-like personality. But think about what the magi do, the wise men. By way of contrast, they're worshiping Jesus, and when they come to Him, they bring the three gifts. Now, some people have tried to connect the three gifts to different aspects of Jesus. For example, some people have said that the gold represents royalty, the frankincense represents His divinity, and the myrrh represents His burial. And whether or not you read those things into what they're doing, the point is this. They're giving everything to Jesus because they perceive the worth that He really is. And here's a question that I have about all this. The Bible clearly shows that God expects to be worshipped. Does that ever bother you? I mean, if somebody walked into this room and demanded that you worship them, what would you think about that person? That they're arrogant. Why is it okay for God to demand it? Other than this. That if He's the creator, and we're supposed to revolve around Him, and He's the sustainer of the world, worshiping Him can be likened to understanding that gravity has to be obeyed, because that's just reality. And if I don't respect gravity, I'm going to kill myself. If I don't respect that God is greater than me, what is that going to do to my life? It's going to cause me to be like Herod, where everything's distorted because I'm trying to make things that should never be God my God. Contrast the differences in attitude between the Magi and Herod. You've got paranoia versus joy. The Magi are exceedingly joyful that they get to worship Jesus, and then you've got Herod, who's worshiping the things of the world, and how is he feeling? He's paranoid. By the way, one of the ways that we can test what we worship is how we're feeling about the direction of our nation. Anybody really getting paranoid about it? It might be an indication that our worship is misplaced. Worship is universal. Everybody does it. But finally, what we have to see here in this scene is how to worship well. So if we see that worshiping false things distorts our lives and ends up bringing destruction into our lives, how is it that we actually worship well in this text? And I'm just going to offer three suggestions. The first one would be determination. These wise men are taking their worldly wisdom, and what they're doing with it is they're laying it all at Jesus' feet. By the way, are these wise men finally acting as wise men? It's the wisest thing that they ever did. But you can imagine that the fellow wise men from their country, I wonder if they would have looked down upon them. We obviously don't know that. But these guys are so determined, no matter what, that they're going to ascribe God his ultimate worth. But the second thing that we see going on here that they did together is they worshiped in community. The text says that there were wise men, plural, so there's multiple ones of them traveling together. Have you ever met somebody who would say something like this? I can worship Jesus and pray by myself, and I don't need a community of people. We all know that when we truly enjoy something, we have to share it with other people. You go to a restaurant that you really like, you have to share it with other people. You really look up to a certain author and you like to read his stuff, you need to share that with other people. And if we really understand the concept of ascribing worth to God, we will understand that we need to do that with other people. But then thirdly, the wise men also needed scripture to worship well. I don't know how they originally understood that the star was supposed to bring them there. But one of the things that we see when they finally got to Jerusalem is that the scripture, Micah 5, was the thing that was finally going to tell them where to go to worship. You're never going to worship well until you worship what in the ways that the scripture says. You don't see the wise men saying to themselves, well, Bethlehem couldn't have been the birthplace. Let's say that it's somewhere else. You don't see that happening. Do people ever approach God that way, though? Where let's disregard what God actually says about proper worship and we'll do things our way, and this would show us that we're not actually worshiping the way that God said, which ultimately isn't ascribing worth to Him. I think it's interesting in this scene that these men were from the east, which means that they had to travel west. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve are expelled, they're evicted from the garden, and they're cast out to the east, which means if they ever wanted to get back to God, they would have to travel west, figuratively speaking. Here you've got humanity. You've got humanity represented in these Magi. And they're traveling west from the east, finally getting back into the presence of God. Because we've got a God who left heaven, came into the form of human body, and sacrificed himself for us. Are you giving God his worth? What is it in your life that you are worshiping? And maybe one of the ways that we can tell that is based on whether we have joy or paranoia. If anybody this morning needs the help of this congregation after examining yourself, this is an opportunity to receive that. If you haven't yet been baptized into Christ, this is an opportunity to start a relationship with him while we stand and while we sing.